Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Yes, 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 yes. Welcome to the Tim McKernan Show. The maiden voyage alongside my producer, the great John Seymour, a.k.a. the Seamaster. I am Tim McKernan. Thank you for joining us on the program. The nice thing is about this is I can curse whenever the interviewees can curse, whenever we aren't bonded by the chains of terrestrial radio. And we also can go as long with our guests and our thoughts as we would like. But to be real candid, I have no idea what direction we will take. I just know that this is something that I've been looking forward to doing really since 2012 when we did a show with Joe Buck for a week and had ridiculously good guests that week. And I thought, my God, I love this podcasting thing. The only thing I miss from doing television, the long form interviews. And with podcasting now, we can do them whenever, wherever. And due to all of the quality work from the Seamaster, it seems like with a lot of great names as well. So that's what we have in store for you here as we launch the Tim McKernan Show. And for the outset, if you're subscribing to the Morning After podcast, TMA podcast, this podcast will automatically download. But eventually, we'll have our own dedicated podcast feed for you to subscribe to. So that is... that's what we got for you. I want to make sure I also thank St. Louis Band Story of the Year for the intro music. The name of the song is Bang Bang from their upcoming album, Wolves. So they were kind enough to let us use that music. I'd love to pick off any random song from the 1980s, but there are legal reasons for not being able to do that. So the boys from Story of the Year were kind enough to send this on over. And so that's what we have here for the inaugural edition of the Tim McKernan Show. What we plan to do with this, and we'll see what winds up happening, maybe in 3 months, the game plan will have changed. But I know out of the gate, what we're visualizing is a long-form interview show. And Gary Pinkle, of course, being our first guest today. Jack Danforth, the former U.S. Senator, is our second guest. We've already sat down with him. And Clay Travis will be our third guest. At least that's how it plans now. But some things might pop up, and then we might have somebody else come in, and then we'll talk it over with him or her as well. I just like the freedom to be able to sit down and bullshit with people. I love doing that, and I've already enjoyed doing it with Gary Pinkle and with Jack Danforth, and I look forward to doing it more and more often, whether it be with somebody from sports, whether it be with somebody from the world of politics, entertainment, somebody we just find fascinating, somebody you, the listener, would love to hear from. That's what I like to do. And so once I get done hosting the Ryan Kelly Morning After every morning, I view this as my second job now. So we are thrilled to launch it today, and how things evolve organically over the next few months, you will find out along with me, whether it be long form interviews, roundtable discussions, or just me sitting in front of a microphone and having random musings with the Plowhawk and with Iggy. We'll see how it all plays out. And because the Seamaster is so damn good, if you have suggestions for guests you would like to hear on the show, for real, don't hesitate to email me at tmckernan@insidestl.com. We certainly have ideas, but we would welcome yours as well. It's a blank canvas, and I love the idea of just showing up and sitting down with somebody in front of a microphone and just going and having a conversation. And while for the most part, we can do that on the Morning After, you know, with a podcast, like, for example, with Gary Pinkle. I mean, when you're sitting in Pinkle's kitchen in Columbia, Missouri, you get stuff that you just wouldn't get if you're doing it over the phone or if it's a press conference or even if you pull him aside at a golf tournament and he says, yeah, I'll give you a few minutes. You just don't. This is a conversation. And so For those of you who are going to sail in and listen to all 82 minutes of it, I think you will hear things that perhaps you never heard before from Gary Pinkel. I think you also will notice Coach Pinkel is certainly relaxed and goes in depth on all kinds of topics as we discuss the 100-yard journey, a life in coaching and battling for the win by Gary Pinkel and St. Louis Post-Dispatch writer Dave Matter. I mean, we talk in depth about some of the most significant seasons in his Missouri tenure, but also the state of the program now and whether or not he feels like the near boyout of the BYU game in November 2015 played a role in where Missouri football is at this point. Pinkel does not hold back. Well, you will hear this. He does not hold back when it comes to his criticism of the way the university handled the situation. Pinkel also discusses his health and even some conspiracy theories regarding the timing of his retirement announcement and his health. So I loved having the conversation with Gary Pinkel. I certainly did not anticipate spending nearly 90 minutes with him, but once we got going, we just kept going, and he couldn't have been more accommodating. So we sat down at Gary Pinkel's home in Columbia for nearly 90 minutes to talk about his book, his career, and his life. Well, first off, Coach, it's an honor to be here in your home. So thank you so much for letting me invade. I don't know if you'll remember this, but this is something that stood out to me, and it's 16 years old. But I was doing television at the time, and I was 24 years old. It was your first year. It was the team picture media day right in front of the old football building.
Okay.
And my photographer from KMOV in St. Louis.
Did he wear the wrong thing?
He wore the Tennessee hat. And from our standpoint, my standpoint as a Missouri guy, I went to school here, I didn't even think about Missouri and Tennessee in like the same world. Yeah. They're winning national championships, and they have Peyton Manning, and I didn't even cross my mind. And you pulled him aside and said, "Why would you wear this around here?" And he goes, "Well, I went to Tennessee. That's my school." And you pulled him aside because you saw your players going, "Oh, yeah, we're gonna have a situation here." Yeah. They didn't know you. It's your first year. And they and you said, "Listen, I'm trying to build something here."
Yeah.
And you wearing that cap sends a message. And if you could, I'll get you a Missouri hat. You can put the Tennessee hat back when you get on in the car.
Yeah.
He gets in the car after we get done doing our interviews, and he goes, "I don't know that guy, but I'm going to tell you, he's going to put you guys in a position to win a Big 12 championship."
And I go, he said that to
yes,
you?
Yes, he did. And I go, "Missouri in the Big 12 championship? Are you out of your mind?" And then sure enough, 6 years later, there
Yeah, that was kind of, we got here, that was just, it was two winning seasons in 17 years, and it was just it was very difficult, to do it the right way, not bring 14 junior college players in. So we had to change a culture. When I got here, I noticed some of the players wearing other university shirts.
Oh, really? Maybe
not in our league, just a few of them. Yeah. I just noticed that, and they didn't think anything of it. I'm doing anything wrong. My girlfriend gave it to me or something like that. So I made a big to-do about that, if you can imagine, saying that, if you wear anything, you wear Missouri stuff.
Right.
And start building some pride here. And so that was kind of one of the things. That's why, I mentioned to that guy at the time, I think I handled it the right way. I didn't say, "Get out of here."
Right.
But we're changing the culture here. And those are little things. There's so many little things it takes to change a football team. But my job is to make sure all those little things were being taken care of.
And in reading the book, which is titled The 100-Year Journey, A Life in Coaching and Battling for the Win, which is available now, you go out of your way to mention calling Larry Smith after the emotional exit from Toledo and asking him about the job, but then also going out of your way to make sure that you never lay blame at the previous administration. You thought that was a very important way to handle things.
Yeah, I talked to all my players afterwards, and I told them, I said, "I don't want you ever hear anything, comparisons, anything. Well, your Coach Pinkel's doing this better, or Larry Smith didn't do this." Or ever complain, for example, our staff. Don't ever complain guys aren't good enough.
Yeah.
These are our players now. So you never heard our guys whine and complain, "Well, I wish we had better players," and things like that. That's all part of the consistency of being respectful to people and throughout your staff, throughout your players, and all those little things is very important in building a football team.
And it seems like
it starts, and a lot of time, you know, honestly, as a guy who went to Missouri, I'm like, I'll flip through the Kent State stuff. I'll flip through the Toledo stuff. Mm-hmm. But then I get engrossed in the early parts of your life because it seems like the foundation was laid for the manner with which you conduct yourself by your parents. You make reference to your mom living by the golden rule and instilling mm-hmm. that in you from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And then also how conscientious your parents were regarding race relations. And we're talking in 1960. And I think that also played a role in not only your ability to reestablish your relationship with the St. Louis community, mm-hmm. but then what took place in 2015. So when I take a look at the whole picture, it became quite fascinating, which is why the book is an incredible read for people, especially Missouri fans. But it's just a great sports book in general. And I look at it all and I think to myself, this man, and I didn't know it at the time, has a plan and a program that he instills and works, and it takes time. And so that 2001, if I'm not mistaken, Texas game mm-hmm. where people were excited that you guys only lost by, I don't even know what it was, 18, 19, 20 points, mm-hmm. you went out of your way right away and said, hey, we're not celebrating moral victories around
here.
Yeah,
I went
set a tone.
I went off on our fan. My players had to hear me say that. You know, we win, you know, they win by a few touchdowns, and we played them really well, and they're a great football team. And so that's okay. You know, we played hard, you know, that kind of thing. Well, there's nothing wrong with playing hard. But you got to, losing's got to feel bad. And you don't get any token wins. And so that was something that I had to make very clear to our fans. Not in a degrading way, but, you know, we got to change our standard around here and our expectation level, mm-hmm. fans, and certainly our players. And my players needed me here, needed me to say that. You know, I was growing up, too, you're talking about our book, The 100-Yard Journey, is my brother and sister, too, had a disease called hereditary spastic paraplegia.
Had no idea about that until I was reading.
They got that when they reached adolescence. They lost their ability to walk. Now, my sister's 3 years older. She lives here in Columbia now. My brother's passed away. He was about 4 or 5 years younger. And the profound effect on me. Well, you know, I see people with special needs, and I see families, and see how they work through all that, and the attention, and all the demands for parents and everybody within those families to help each other. It's a whole different world you live in. But one thing you learn real quick too is I'm very, very sensitive and very, very respectful of people that are less fortunate. And I went through a lot of guilt feelings when I didn't get the same disease. I just didn't get it.
Right.
And but that had a profound effect on me for the rest of my life.
Yeah, you mentioned that here you are playing at, you know, for Don James at Kent State. Your sister already had dealt with what she had dealt with her yeah. diagnosis. And while you're there, if I'm not mistaken, you said that's when your brother received.
I got a phone call. Yeah, I got a phone call and said that he has the same. Well, he was having trouble walking around. And we talked about
this
book.
Did you sense that was coming once you saw the
symptoms? I didn't want it to be. So I went back and worked, and I gave him agility drills, things that I did to help him try to change his, you know, help his quickness. I mean, he grew kind of fast. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, oh, God, don't let that happen to this guy. And then it was, they took him and found out he had the same thing. So that was emotionally really difficult for me. But anyway, you know, families, you know, everybody goes through different things. And that was certainly, it was our family. But we held together tight. You know, we were a good family. It was very, I think I was brought up very, my parents were around all the time. They loved me and cared about me. And I tell my players that, too, because I've been in a lot of my homes with my players, and I like to get in all my players' homes because I want to know what their background is and how I can help them, how I can understand them. And I tell my players, I grew up like, you know, my mom and dad, we went through some tough times, you know, about my brother and sister. There's a lot of things we had to do that were involved in that. But my mom and dad loved me, you know, and I was very, very responsible. Unlike a lot of you guys, went through a lot different situations. And then that gets into the respect of our teammates for all their other teammates, understanding we're so cross-cultural in here. We have to have a deeper understanding. And we changed that later on. We called crossover dinners, where we put 6 or 9 or 10 guys go to different coaches.
Right.
And then they would talk about their back. They just say, I'm Gary Pinkle. I grew up in Akron, Ohio, or, you know, whatever. You know, I'm Chase Daniel. I grew up in Dallas, Texas. And those things were really, really important. And we talk about that in the book, for us to understand one another and have a trust in one another.
And so what I sense from reading the book is that you have an understanding of empathy, I guess, for lack of a better term, mm-hmm. which when you're thinking of a college football coach, and what do we know, you know, having never done it, you're thinking, okay, game management decisions. Okay, how did he do against Kansas? Whatever the case might be, what happened here against Auburn in the SEC championship game? But then you learn some of the elements of your life and your upbringing that then played a role in who you are, which I think allowed you to relate to people and then built trust with your players, which then played a role in the program. That seems like that's, I don't want to call it a formula, because then that would make it seem like your parents had some kind of strategy to build a college football coach. They just raised you the right way.
The word you just mentioned, the most important word you just mentioned, was trust.
Yeah.
And ultimately, you don't get ownership unless you get trust. And I told, you know, I tell our staff, you know, don't expect our players to passionately care about this program if they don't feel like we passionately care about them. So that's why I went into home. So I want to know and empathy, and also just how to deal with the kids. Understand this guy might have a much more difficult time adjusting to this part of our program, and this guy is going to be probably simple for. And so that's really why. It's a better understanding, because my responsibility was to get those kids graduated, help develop them as young men. You know, we did those things in our program. We just didn't talk about them because they sound cute.
Right.
But that was a responsibility that I had. And you know, there was times when I did different things per week. You know, I would talk about real men and talk about responsibility of a man. We take a lady out to how you treat her when you take her out, and more fatherly advice. I did a lot of that stuff with our players, especially at the end of my career a little bit more, because I felt I had to do more to help my kids.
That is something that I think people really appreciate. At the same time, people don't know. The fan doesn't know that stuff. So when I read throughout the book, again, it's the 100-yard journey, a life in coaching and battling for the win. Nick Saban wrote the foreword.
How about that?
That was, and again, like when you guys were playing in the 2014 SEC championship game, I'm like, oh, they're friends. They knew each other from, I didn't realize. So you guys used to drive, I mean, my God. I'm like,
we're graduate assistants together.
Yeah,
and everything,
but
so.
Then it wasn't just like you said, because when I started here at KOMU-TV, there was 3/4-inch editing. I'm like, man, this effing sucks. But that was nothing compared to leaving where you are in Ohio and what, driving to Pittsburgh?
Yeah, about an hour and 45 minutes. Yeah.
So it's you and Saban in the car together?
And they have to splice it all and everything.
Yes, that's what I remember, so. That crap. So, those, but I mean, days. That was obviously
his take on that was he was firing all the graduate assistants that press buttons and it instantly does it. But it was a great forward. He
so
wrote
you
that.
And Saban are in a car every, is that what
yeah,
it was?
Yeah, yeah, we did that a lot.
See, so, I didn't realize just like, oh, they kind of knew each other from Kent State.
We were teammates together, and you know, I'm really proud of him. You know, he's at a place that obviously you can win at a very high level, and he's doing it more consistently than anybody. But the forward he wrote, when I first read the forward, I said, I looked at my wife Missy, and I said, he wrote every word of this. I didn't necessarily think he was going to do it because he's so busy. Maybe give some bullet points and have somebody else. Because that wouldn't have bothered me at all. But it was every word he wrote.
Yeah,
and it was very personal, and he said things to me that he's never said to me before. You know, it's kind of like a lot of people that know that kind of said it was just his shot to do it. And he's a remarkable coach, and I appreciate him writing the foreword of the book.
You guys, because people see him on his interviews, and you see you in your interviews, and it's like there's this, but now I get it. I totally get it. Yeah. There has to be kind of like a wall. Keep your players protected and take the crap when crap's going down.
Yeah.
Disperse the credit when things are going well.
Yeah, this is the Don James deal.
That's the Don James thing. You make reference to it in the book. But it sounds like, I mean, when you're away from the football field, you know, and when people always say, oh, I played golf with Coach Pinkel, and he's just like so relaxed and so chill. And I go, yeah, it's probably because he's not at work. What about you're giving me a look like, I don't know if that's necessarily the case.
No, I agree with that. I think people have to understand that, you know, you're in the, you know, everybody watches everything you do all the time, which is okay. It's not a big deal for me. But, you know, you're on, and your people ask you, and they're all the time. And
a 10-second interaction can be their life judgment of you, which is,
I'm always respectful of people, because that's what my mom coming down from heaven has whacked me if I wasn't, okay? But people have to understand, too, you live in this intense world, you know, kind of what Barry's going through right now. You know, it's until you're head coach, you don't know what it's like, you know, when you're getting fired on. And you try to, you know, less is more. You don't run around. I made a mistake saying once to somebody, hey, nice meeting you. And the guy looked at me. Oh. I think it was Kansas City. He goes, Coach, I met you 5.5 years ago.
You got to go with nice seeing you. You got to go with nice seeing you.
That's
the play.
That went into place about 15 years ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've always been respectful to all our fans. But, you know, during the season, you're
locked in.
You're locked in. You're in a different, you're kind of in a zone. You're going to live there. And you're very calculated. You know, anything I said at any press conference, anything I did, I knew he was going to say it before I got there. And it just, that's just the way, if you do it right, I think, that's kind of the life you live at the time.
Right. So you get to Columbia, and here's the thing. Now, I talked about the little Tennessee hat thing, which still stands out to me. But I feel like you can get a read on a guy as a coach, basketball coach, football coach, maybe even the non-revenue generating sports. I don't know. But specifically to the ones that we cover and we try to act like we know what we're talking about, and who knows if we even know a tenth of what's really going on, if that. But I remember when you were hired, December 2000, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. that it killed you to leave Toledo. And it killed you to do so and then have to go in and make sure you saw your guys and tell them that you were leaving. And to me, even though I didn't know what the hell was going to go on, and I had watched Woody Woodenhofer and Bob Stull and Larry Smith, and obviously there were some rough years, successful coaches elsewhere, but rough years in Columbia, and I thought, that tells you about the guy that's coming in here, because you wanted to make sure that you did that, even though it's a brutal process.
Yeah, it was emotionally awful. I mean, it was, you know, you're so committed to those kids, and I'd been there 10 years, and It really, you know, for a while until my son straightened me out a little bit, you know, because he knew a bunch of those players. He was going to school there at the time, my oldest son. I walked away from that, and there was anger, there was frustration. And when my son Jeff grabbed me, you know, later on that evening, he called me and he said, "Hey, Dad, they loved you. They loved all the coaches. By the way, they won 2 championships the next 2 years. We left a loaded team mm-hmm. there, you know." And and they were insecure, and he said the reason they were mad because they wanted you to stay. It is in no way did it reflect their real feelings. And I was, you know, I really never been in that situation before, so that was a little bit naive about it, I guess. But I had to do that. You know, mm-hmm. some coaches don't. I'm sorry I couldn't make it. I couldn't be there, guys. I could not do that.
Yeah.
It would not do that.
But that tells you a lot about it. And so you come in, and obviously it's rough out of the gate. And to me, as I take myself back to after the 2002 season, I don't know what your mindset was, but after the 2002 season, we're only talking 2 years in. Coaches get whacked now after mm-hmm. 2 years, mm-hmm. sometimes less, very mm-hmm. rare, but it happens. And I wonder if Twitter were around in 2002, if you would have gotten the run that you wound up having in Columbia.
I don't know. I think one thing that was very important for me when I came here was Mike Alden. And I told Mike, I need a rock here. I need somebody to really help me because this is going to be very difficult. And oh, by the way, what you did in the past, you just fired coaches, fire coach, fire coach, fire coach. And as that happens, it all piles on the next guy that gets there.
Right.
And so I had a lot of confidence in Mike. I think Mike understood, because I communicated to him well, everything I told him I was going to do, I did. And very well organized, a plan for everything that I'm doing. He also got a chance to talk to players. He also, I think, saw, you know, from other people in the athletic department watching how we operationally did, even though we weren't very good, they saw that, you know, this guy, he's got a system here. Mm-hmm. So you get a program in place.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if social networking would have been remarkably different in my situation, you know, changing the culture that we had. You know, this is obviously a lot different than you know, what Barry and got in, you know, different places like that. I mean, we had a lot of issues. And, hey, you know, I pray in the book here, 100 Yard Journey, I really praise those kids that stuck with us.
Right.
Losing, winning, losing.
Mm-hmm.
Holy smokes. But then it flipped.
Right.
And thank God for Mike Alden and the administration here for believing in me and believing in what we do.
I didn't realize, and in the book refreshed my memory, that the 2005 season, if I'm not mistaken, that you were staring down the barrel of potentially losing at home to Baylor. Is that where it was 4th-and-1 and Brad Smith busted off the 50-plus yard run, that you said that was a defining moment. Had he not picked up that first down, forget about the touchdown,
mm-hmm.
and Baylor had the momentum after being down 24 points, you potentially lose that game, what that could have meant at that point, because you're talking about 4 out of 5 losing seasons for your first 5 seasons.
Yeah, that was a huge huge game for us, and there comes games like that. I never wanted to make it sound like in that book that I was just sitting around worried about my job all the time, because I wasn't. I focused on doing my job. I was very good at doing that, letting all the other stuff go. You have to learn how to do that in this position. If not, they're just gonna it'll gobble you up and spit you out.
So when people saw Barry after the loss to Auburn, people were then making the comparison. I think Ben Fredrickson was on our show on Monday after that game, and he said the thing that Gary Pinkel was so good at was blocking out all the noise. And you make reference to, we do what we do, but you would always say it, and that's because there was a program. So it's kind of like, hey, people don't like it, but we do what we do. We mm-hmm. know the program works, so you can.
Yeah, that Mike Alden used to get mad at me.
Yeah,
because we would be having some tough times or anything. So we're not going to change a thing. He'd run in my office. You're not going to change a thing. You can't tell people. You can't tell people you're not going to change a thing. Well, we're not going to. In fact, you know, after 2012, when that first losing season in 7 years,
right,
a lot of injuries, and I didn't, all we had to do was win one more game, and I didn't get that done. I said that out loud at the time, and people were just irate, you know? And but it was the truth. It wasn't in your face. It was when if you believe in what you're doing, when you're having great adversities, you go back and you make sure, not that you're going to make little changes. We make little changes all the time in our program, but we go back to the foundation of who we are. And we did. We won two championships right in a row.
Absolutely.
And that had a lot to do with it.
So I hear that, and it seemed like there was a moment, and I remember people would always criticize this, but you addressed it in the book. You didn't want to just whack assistants just as sacrificial lambs to ingratiate yourself, whether it be to the fans, the athletic director, boosters, whomever. You would not do that. And you sensed it after the 2004 season, if I'm not mistaken. And you told Mike Alden, these are my guys.
Well, I'm not gonna fire a guy, have his family move, just to say, oh, Gary Pinkel's, you know, he's making some staff changes. Yeah, I wasn't going to do that. I never have done that. On the same token, I have fired a few player guys. And I try to also, I coach my coaches, too. So if a coach is needs help in a certain area, you know, that's what I do. And, you know, I think that's, you know, a lot of programs, you know, turn coaches around. And it was interesting, when I got here and we were going through this area, it was the MAC, Mid-American Conference. They're MAC coaches. You got all these MAC coaches. MAC coaches aren't good enough. I heard outside that this stuff was going on. And then later on as it went, boy, that was one of the greatest things Gary Pinkel ever did, was keep those MAC coaches because they stayed here and they believed in what we did. And they all had opportunities to leave. But they're at a program really, really struggling. But guess what? We were soldiers. You know, they knew it worked. It worked at Kent State. It worked at Washington. It worked at Toledo. And it was going to work at Missouri.
Yeah.
And that's what we used to tell recruits in St. Louis, for example. We got here, you know, they're used to coming in, you know, and here's a new coach, new head football coach.
We've seen this
a lot of times, right. And we're going to get it done. But I used to go in there with that model, and I looked at him. I said, I didn't make this up, guys. I'm just telling you this. So I used to go to Kent State, Washington, Toledo. This stuff works. And I felt all the time it would. And you know why? Because it's true.
Yeah, and it had. There was a track record there. You make reference to that with St. Louis, and I'm really curious about that. Demetrius Johnson, 2001, mm-hmm. You get hired, and you have this meeting right outside the airport, if I'm not mistaken, hotel.
Yeah, at the Marriott right there. Right. Yeah, it was.
And I had always heard this stuff. I went to St. Louis U High, so I have a good relationship with Gary Kornfeld, and I noticed a lot of great players, great coach. A lot of successful players would go on from SLU, but it seemed like a lot of them would go to Illinois. Very rarely at the time would they come to Missouri. And I would hear, yeah, there's just like kind of a wall between St. Louis and Columbia. You talk about the meeting, but what was the actual root of the wall?
Well, I think there was that we just felt that there was just some race issues, you know, that kind of, I felt it. And talking to Demetrius, we just got hit this in the face. You know, we're not going to sit there and tiptoe around this. We need to get to all, and he might have even suggested it, and I agreed, we need to get everybody together. In St. Louis area that played football. No, there are not any issues in Kansas City. I never heard any of those other issues, but St. Louis, just that's the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a bunch of players from St. Louis that came to that meeting. And a lot of people stood up and said things, and they were very, very honest. It was very, very, very uncomfortable at times. In fact, one time I said, if you feel uncomfortable, everybody, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody feels like it's safe, and, you know, that's okay to feel uncomfortable here. That's how we're going to kind of resolve some things here. And I thought that, you know, it didn't make things great overnight, but that was the healing started a little bit then. And I thought, I felt that those race type relations really became a lot better. And in fact, you know, we went from having 150 people show up to our spring game to bring all the players back at reunion to, you know, 600, 700, 800 as time went on with their families and such. So it was neat to do that. But that was a very, very important. I'm very appreciative of Demetrius Johnson for being a part of that, because that was very, very important that we get done with that.
I think this, of course, would fly under the radar. People would point at games, whether it be Nebraska in 03 or whether it would be what took place, of course, to get things going in 2007 against Illinois. But your recognition of the problem, for whatever it was, between St. Louis and Columbia, and addressing it head on, was perhaps one of the most significant efforts of your coaching career at Mizzou. And then I go back to the early chapters of the 100-yard journey, and you write and acknowledge, my God, in 2017, acknowledging that you said the N-word, even if you were like 8 years old when you said it, but you say the N-word, it gets back to your mom. She hears about that, and the first thing she does is grab you and
gets a washcloth, lathers it up, puts it in my mouth, and I can remember this to this day. Our bathroom was about the size of 3x3 in that little house we were at, and just turning it in to my mouth, and then pulling out, and just her saying, "You treat all people with respect, everybody with respect. That's what you do." And
that's ahead of the time.
Oh yeah, that had to have been. I'm not sure what it was in there. Probably 62 or something like that. I was born in 52. So that was when there were all kinds of things happening in our country. That decade was huge,
right?
And Martin Luther King and making huge advancements. Should have been done a long time before that, but that was happening.
So that's a part of you, and that's not. I mean, why would anybody really know that? I think people just kind of assume. Well, everybody, you grew up in this time, then you probably think this way. You grew up here, you may think that way, which is completely unfair. That's also stereotyping, but the point is that you had empathy for people in general, but the African-American community, which perhaps allowed you, going back to the word, trust to have credibility with the St. Louis African-American community to open up the door between St. Louis and Columbia and have the recruiting pipeline that you began to build.
Yeah, I think that the word sincerity is really a really important word when I talk to people or meet people or listen to people. People that are really, really sincere, you can feel it. They're not just saying this because it sounds good.
Right.
It sounds that good.
Right.
And hopefully I came across that way, that, I'm not trying to just make things happen, win games here. We're trying to, solve some problems. And hopefully they felt it deep down in my heart, the sincerity that I felt and had, they could feel that.
And the byproduct is you get one of the greatest recruits from St. Louis that we had seen, and that's Jeremy Maclin, to flip his commitment from Oklahoma. That times out with Chase Daniel. And he was going into his second year after Macklin's injury, and he misses 2006. And you open up the season against Illinois. I remember being at that game, and I remember writing about it, so this shows how much I know. Not that you were under the impression you were sitting here with Vince Lombardi, but who you also, by the way, ran into. What a great story. I'm going to digress all over the damn place here. But I mean, you're the NFL championship game with your dad in 68.
Yeah, they were playing the, their player playing the, they,
it was
they the,
Colts,
the Colts,
I think. Browns and Colts, right?
And my dad finally got tickets late because we couldn't afford to, buy tickets. And one of this guy works for General Tire Rubber Company, and they got tickets late. And so we're walking up late, and this limousine pulls up, and it's probably about 6 or 7 minutes into the first quarter, so there's hardly anybody out there. This limousine pulls up, and this guy gets out, and he's got a Russian hat. I call him Russian hats, for lack of a better term. And it's Vince Lombardi. I told my dad, I said, "Dad, that's Vince Lombardi." And we just stopped, and he came over, and he, patted me on the back, and asked me about what I played football, what position I played, and that kind of thing. And isn't that interesting?
Oh, my God.
And I've read everything about Vince Lombardi, but nowadays, I'd have a phone, I'd be able to take a picture of it real quick.
Yeah.
But that was one of those things that
the interaction stood with you, didn't it? Because he said, make sure you take care of your studies, even in this probably 2 minute interaction.
Yeah, it was really really incredible experience.
And
for someone that eventually did this for a living.
I mean, an amazing story. And it's all in the book, and you talk about the 2007 season, how you open up against Illinois. I remember walking out of there, and I wrote about it. It was a fun game, entertaining as hell, but I'm like, I just don't know if these teams are very good. Well, one winds up in the Cotton Bowl, one winds up in the Rose Bowl, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Sugar Bowl, one or the other. Illinois went to the Rose Bowl, I think Ohio State played in the BCS championship game. When you're standing on the sidelines during that game and then after the win, can you tell that you got something there?
Yeah, impact players you can. I mean, Brad Smith had his coming
out party.
Absolutely,
2002.
There. People said, where the heck did they get that guy? And so, J-Mac and, he was certainly, you just saw him change a game. He's a different level guy. Blaine Gabbert was the same way when he went in there. He had a huge game against those guys.
Yep.
So, you get a good feeling, coming out of there and really seeing those type of players. And that was, we were very fortunate that, we did pretty good in that game against Illinois.
And that set the table. You go to Ole Miss, you win that one, and you're undefeated going into Norman to take on Oklahoma.
And we had to learn how to win and be successful the next week, and the next week, the next week. We've never been like that before.
Right.
We have big wins. You want to go out and celebrate, and you might not get the focus necessary, although I try to get it all the time. If you want to be good, you got to be able to win back to back to back to back. People writing about you and all those other things, and you just don't snap fingers and that happens. That's things that you do in your program, you know, in January, so you can handle it there. Yeah. And past experiences and developing the leaders on your team, the player leadership that we worked on all the time, all the way from January, all the way. People don't realize that. We just don't go out and say, you be a leader. There's a plan in place for all that stuff.
And you had that with that group.
Yeah, no question.
Sure,
no question.
On both sides.
And honestly, we did it with the groups, you know, really all the way through when we started. We're just teaching them how to think right and how to be Missouri Tigers.
And so the time comes, you're undefeated. You're going into Norman, Oklahoma. And I remember, because people talk about that game leading into the Big 12 championship game, go, oh, they got blasted against Oklahoma. And I'm like, man, I watched that game, and I might be seeing it through black and gold glasses, but Missouri was in that game against Oklahoma. The score was not indicative of how tight the game was.
They had a couple scores at the end, which really kind of blew it out, because at the beginning of the third quarter, we're in the game. You know, we're close. I can't remember exactly what it was. But, you know, eventually they're a great football team, and they've been in that arena a bunch of times, and they did the things necessary. It was a great learning experience for our players, being able to play back-to-back in high-level football games. You beat a Nebraska, you got a great game the next week, type of thing.
Right.
And, you know, those things you learn, and that was the biggest thing come out of that, we're a good football team.
Right.
But we got to learn how to, we got to play your A game all the time. You know, you got to play it at that level, and that's what we try to do.
So I recall the Monday after that Oklahoma game, I said, I know this is going to sound crazy. I said, but I'm looking at Missouri's schedule, and so this is like the middle of October, so nothing, Armageddon and Arrowhead was, way off on the horizon, but KU was undefeated. And I go, I'm looking at Kansas's schedule, and I'm thinking to myself, there's a chance that Missouri and Kansas could mean the world, which sounds insane for football. And sure enough,
you would have got booed on that one.
So I said, I think it's in Missouri's best interest to pull for Kansas, because then that would make that game bigger and the win bigger. And I think, with all due respect, and I know it's awkward for me to say, Missouri's a much better football team than Kansas. Kansas has a much favorable schedule this year. They didn't have to travel to Norman. Mm-hmm. They didn't have Illinois on a neutral site. They didn't travel to Oxford. So sure enough, it builds up. You keep winning, they keep winning. And
by the way, I'd never root for Kansas. Ever.
That is officially on the record.
Ever. And will never.
So it builds up. Armageddon at Arrowhead. And you talk about that 2-mile-an-hour drive through the parking lot and what you see and how it reminded you of Rose Bowls.
Rose Bowls, our fans were banging on the buses. It was game day. One of the great atmospheres ever.
For real.
It was almost like a national championship type atmosphere. It was great venue, great place to play, Arrowhead Stadium. And it was a heck of a football game. Two really, really good football teams. It was fans freezing cold, fans standing the entire game.
I was one of them.
And I knew going into the game, and I mentioned this in the book, The 100-Yard Journey, I remember going to the game saying my prayers and saying, God, this is going to be the biggest game ever in the history of these two teams. It probably will never, ever happen again. And I just said, please let me win this game. I don't think he cares who wins games,
But, yeah, right.
Why not try? So,
is there anything from that day, from the locker room, from afterwards, that you didn't mention in the 100-yard journey? Because, for me, I love, we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of it. And I love it. If it pops up on, ESPN, I'm like, I'm going to settle in and watch this thing. Cause it was great entertainment, much less the atmosphere. Anything stand out to you?
It was just the entire atmosphere. It was hard to describe. It was like a bowl game atmosphere, like I mentioned, like being in Pasadena, the Rose Bowl. Which I was fortunate enough to coach in those. It was a game where we had players make plays in big situations, but it was the intensity was different than any game I'd ever been a head coach in ever. Mm-hmm. Okay, and certainly I think our players felt the same way. Yeah. But. There's so many things. I actually watched it on TV the first time.
You did? I thought in the book you said you never watch a game. Did?
I just did.
You just did?
I just did.
What were you doing?
Well, when the SEC Network, we had our Mizzou
Day.
Yes,
that was awesome. Yeah.
And they had that show on there.
Absolutely.
And so I got to do that. And then we also honored the 2017, our first game. I got to see it then,
So you sit and watch it by yourself? You watch it with your wife?
Well, no, I had a bunch of friends over here.
Uh-huh.
And we watched it kind of.
So
a
what do you think
people.
As you're watching it?
Oh, it was just awesome. It was, you go back to different plays and you remember how close this could have been, how close this, we made this play, the sack in the end zone.
Yes, that's
those
the type,
there's a lot of things like that. I think we tried a fake that didn't work in the game or something too. So it's just, I'm going to go watch. I'm going to start watching a lot more. I haven't watched any more since I said I was going to start watching one a week, you know, which I can do now. But I remember Coach James said when he retired, he actually went back and started watching some games. And now we have access to everything.
Yeah.
And fortunately, we had a lot of big games.
Yeah. Oh, well, none bigger than that one. I always wondered, were you inadvertently, because you make reference, and I didn't even know this as a fan, that you would always, anytime you would play Oklahoma, you either had Nebraska the week before or a week after. That's interesting.
Almost every time.
To say the least. Yeah. Just like I find it fascinating that rarely do SEC schools come up to Columbia in November.
I called the commissioner on that one, too.
On what, the SEC thing that I'm talking about, or the Oklahoma-Nebraska?
No, the Oklahoma-Nebraska. Ah. I called the commissioner on that.
Isn't that
one.
Weird? It can't
and
be.
And I said, this is not, you know, are you telling me this is chance?
Yeah, I mean, this every is not year.
Yeah, so, and, you know, I didn't go public with that in any way because I didn't want my players ever to hear me say anything like that or our fans ever to hear me.
Right.
But I'm just looking at the schedule, so what the heck's going on
every
right here,
year.
You know? And, you know, a lot of in the SEC, there's a lot of the old school, it's a great conference and great commissioners and everything, but the old school scheduling is still in.
Sure.
Where Auburn and Alabama, before their final game, mm-hmm. they always give them a bye week.
Right.
Is that by chance? You think that's by chance? You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
And so those things, you know, I think when you marry into a league, that kind of happens a little bit. So, but, you know, if I ever whine, I whine behind the scenes. I never whine in front of anybody.
I don't think it's a coincidence, and I'm not trying to put you in a weird spot. This is me opining, and once again, knowing that I don't know my ass from a hole in the ground, but that the SEC schools rarely come up to Columbia, minus the Arkansas back and forth in November.
Yeah. You know?
And
yeah.
I just think that's probably not a coincidence.
Yeah.
You guys
yeah.
are on the road, and, you know.
Who knows?
Yes, exactly.
Those that win in November will be remembered.
That's what wound up happening in 2007. So you play this game, and it's got everything that we just made reference to, but then you still got another one, which is essentially a semifinal for the national championship, the BCS championship at the time. When you look back on the Oklahoma game in 2007, what stands out in that one?
Well, I think when we got that missed call, you know, we had that fumble. I believe that's the game that way. It was the 20-yard line. We had the ball coming out, and it was just a communication problem between the quarterback and one of the receivers. One of the coaches miscommunicated it, and there was a quarterback running back exchange. They get the ball because, you know, we were in the game. We had momentum. Things were going good, and all of a sudden they get the thing and score right away, and then from that point on it kind of flipped.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you got to win those. And I'll probably also be known as the guy that, you know, played in four divisional championships, won five, but played in four divisional championships and didn't win the championship.
Yeah.
And I regret that, you know. I feel good about getting Missouri's name in the championship where it's in the stadium up on there for divisional championships, because that's very important. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you know, you're responsible for that. And I didn't get that done. Wish I could have.
Yeah. Well, the 2008 team had a bunch of guys returning after winning that Cotton Bowl. And you make reference to, that's a team that was too good to lose four games.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there were two that were certainly sitting there to be won.
Yeah.
Oklahoma State and Kansas.
And that's Gary Pinkel being a head coach on the national level, you know, with great teams. We were top five ranked, I think.
Number three going to the Oklahoma State game, I think.
Yeah. And not, you know, kind of riding up, not, you know, just being a little more demanding on our players than you normally are, you know, just keeping them at the cutting edge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of them are going to get drafted probably. A lot of them, the NFL all of a sudden is coming into the play. Am I going to play in the NFL? These guys are looking at me. You know, all those things that kids naturally do and all the success they've heard over the last year. And, you know, so 2018, I thought maybe it would have been the best one we had overall, maybe.
Going into the season, you thought that?
No. Going in, I thought we were going to have a great football team.
Oh, sure. How can you not?
Back.
Yeah.
And we won. Plus, we know how to win now. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there's, you know, things are pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the end of the day, you know, I didn't get that done. So, you know, I mean, in that book, The 100-Yard Journey, one thing I'll do is I'll, you know, if I'm at fault,
talk about
when it. I wrote the book, I wanted to make sure that I was just honest with everything.
I know. And you know,
that's real important for me to be like that.
You get into some things that I didn't know going in if you were going to get into them.
Yeah.
And I clearly that was a conscious decision to do so.
Yeah.
The DWI, your divorce. How do you, you know, I'm sure there had to be a process on, okay, I got to get into this. How do I handle getting into
it? I think, you know, you're real. You live a real life. You know, you're not this special person that's, you know, dropped into Columbia, Missouri, and everything goes good well for them all the time. You know, obviously getting divorced is, you know, that's just a personal thing. So that's, you know, that happens all the time. But so it happened to me. The DWI, I never hurt anybody in my life. I was 60 years old. I never hurt my football team. I never hurt my family. I never hurt anybody. And I, for a guy that's never had a shot in his life, I mean, I ended up getting a DWI. Are you kidding me? Yeah, but I decided in the book, as I talk about it and you can read about it, to own it, you know, and own it. Mm-hmm. And my players were very much watching how I was going to handle this, you know. And so I handled it the right way so they could see how I handled it and they might be able to apply it, not getting a DWI, but how Coach Pinkel's handling personal adversities. Right. How's he handling it?
Right.
So I felt it was more than just, you know, me getting through it. It was more also about the responsibility I had and how I conducted myself and owned it and earned their respect back than anything else.
That all comes within a year that has incredible things on and off the field going on for you, as we make reference to you address them. That 2010 team was undefeated, beats Oklahoma, number one team in the country, and you want to talk about a great atmosphere. You had Arrowhead Stadium, but then this one's at Faurot Field. John McGaffey's return. Just, I mean, that place,
great,
shaking,
great game.
The building
shaking.
One
of those nights you remember being in the zoo.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it started in the quadrangle with College Game Day, and then it built up all night. So you beat them, and then things, and you're on the phone with Don James enjoying it, and he says, you know, it's great, but you got to worry about.
How about him saying
yeah,
that?
How about that? I mean, what a buzzkill, man.
Yeah, it's in the book, but for all the people listening to this, you know, so we won this big, big game.
Number one in the country.
And we had a good team, number one in the country. And so we're driving back. I decided 2 hours difference back in Seattle. So I'm going to call Coach James up and, you know, just kind of thank him because, you know, how I feel about him. And I told him, da, 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 da. And he says, Gary, excuse me a second here, right at the end. He says, hey, listen, the biggest game you're going to play is going to be next week. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, I didn't want to hear that. I don't want to hear that. That's a boy.
I
that's
enjoy this, man. Yeah,
but he's right. And, you know, and honestly, and I talk about that. You know, we lose two back-to-back games then, Nebraska, and then we go to TCU, and then one of our players comes
Nebraska
up.
And Texas Tech, right?
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Texas Tech. Yeah. Yep, for sure. And we lose Texas Tech because we've done pretty good against Texas Tech over the years. But we didn't play very well down there either, and our team wasn't playing well. And Kevin Rutland came up, and I talk about this in Bush. He comes in, knocks on my door and says, Coach, we're in a funk. And I said, we are. I said, yeah. I said, that's all I need to know. Thank you. And that's where leadership is awesome. Well, we got out of the funk right away.
So what'd you do?
And then I got the seniors together, talked to them, and then I got the team together. And we cranked it up different than we normally do. The intensity level of everybody in that, even though we always coach intense, it was notched up about five notches. And the players were around and going, what the heck is going around here? And I just, you know, I talked about getting back in the winner's circle, and I think this is what's necessary to get us back in the winner's circle.
Right.
And we'd be, I think, Colorado the next week, or somebody. We come back through, and we finish the season very strong.
And then they wind up going to a bowl, heartbreaking loss to Iowa, which you make reference to. 2011 team has some struggles, goes to a bowl, beats North Carolina, and then you're in the process of making the move to the SEC. I think it goes without saying, but maybe it does need to be said, if you don't have the success that you have in 07, 8, and 10, I don't think SEC is talking to Missouri.
I mean, they're not. I mean, I talked to, you know, different people from the SEC. There's no question. They were not going to bring somebody in that didn't have some strength in
Absolutely.
Football. That's what they're going to do. And, location-wise, I think we touch four states also. So I think we're extreme at one end of the northwest corner, but we do. My whole thing with the entire, you've heard me say this before I said in the book, my whole thing was I just if you're going to get in this league, because this league is really good. There's more good teams in this league year in, year out than any league in the country. If you're going to get in, you better invest.
Yeah.
You know, go in there and just say, well, rank our facilities 10, 11, 12, but you just go win all your games. It's not going to work that way. And so that understanding, I think they understood that. And, you know, we're building the South End Zone now, which is a dream of mine. It was 3 years ago. And so I'm so excited about that because that had to get done. And Mike Alden built East Side Addition now that changed the landscape of the stadium forever with the big deck on the other side. And so a lot of things have happened, but that's just to be you. This isn't the South End Zone. Not going to be the end of it.
Right.
You know, we're going to have to build something else in this league, and that's just how competitive it is.
That's the SEC. That's a defining moment. Are you thinking at that time, kind of like, I know I'm in Columbia for good when that happens, or was what took place in 2010, which you go into detail quite a bit, actually? I didn't realize how close you were to taking it to the next level with Michigan discussions following their 2010 season, which Brady Hoke took that gig, and that's a guy, you know, and it played tight against San Diego State with the DJ Bowl.
What was interesting for me when I talked to the representative from Michigan, he kept telling me, he said, you get to, he said, you, the program that's worked here, 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 the difference is here at Michigan is you get to recruit anybody you want and have a great chance of getting them. And even though recruiting got better and better for us here and so on and so forth, it's just different, you know, it's a different place. And there's not many places like it. And that was the most intriguing thing to me, mm-hmm. you know. But at the end of the day, I just didn't want to do it. So I backed out of it.
But I got to ask why. But, I mean, when you're sitting in that hotel room in Dallas and you're like, tell them I don't want to do it, why?
I just told them, I just didn't want to make the move. I didn't want to, all my family was here in Missouri, all three of my kids, grandkids, everybody was here. Not that I couldn't have moved to Michigan.
Sure.
And then I asked myself, do you really want to start over?
Right.
Do you want to start over?
Right.
Because it wasn't easy. Now, it would be a lot, nothing's easy. The time frame would be a lot different, obviously, there. If you know what you're doing. I think we knew what we were doing. But, you know, for me, it was just, I've always been a little bit of a homebody. I never want a guy bounce around. I never went to Toledo and pull a bunch of JC guys in, come to here, to Missouri, and you know, let's win and get out of here. My goal was never to get out of here. My goal was here to win a prospective program nationally year in, year out. That was my goal. And it just didn't sound good at a press conference. That's what it was.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I didn't want to start all over and have to remove all my family. I just, you know, let's keep going here and let's keep getting better.
Well, obviously, Missouri fans are glad you did because it gave them the 2013 season. And not only did you have success on the field, perhaps, like you said, with 2007, you had a sense, but perhaps that sense was one of the most unique in college football. You guys had talked about as coaches, I mean you guys, what would it be like if you have a gay football player? Somebody's going to have it, and then, as it turns out, you're the person who has that first situation. And Michael Sam tells the team, is that a correct portrayal?
Well, we had meetings going on, and he told the group that he was with, we had those crossover meetings,
right,
where you're talking about different things that are going on.
And this is going on like in August before the season?
Yeah, this is everybody's meeting with different, and they're talking about their backgrounds and everything, and he just told his teammates they were gay, and I got a call from Coach Kulgowski, and he says, you know, this has happened. I said, okay. Okay, so what I did is I called Chad Moeller, let him know what was going on. I just, you know, because something could happen media-wise right away if somebody got out.
Yes.
And I just want to be aware of that. And then I just had Mike, you know, I talk about it in the book here, but I, you know, I got Michael up there the next day, you know, hugged him, told him I loved him. How do you want to do this? And so we brought Chad in to say what was going to happen if you do decide to come out like this now. And just tell him the facts. And if he wants to do it, I'm in. And he knows that. You know, he knew that. You know, anywhere we go from that now on that season, any team we play, you're going to have demands for media on every place you go. It's going to be a whole different world for you. And if you want to do that, I'm in. And Chad said the same thing, you know, so, you know, we did agree with me. And so what happened was next day he came in and said, you know, I don't want to put the team through that. I just don't want to do that. I'll do it sometimes after the season's over. I said, anytime you want to do it, you're going to walk in my office and you're going to tell me we're going to do it. And then we're going to get it organized and get it done to help you. He says, okay, coach, and that's kind of how it happened. Mm-hmm. I was on, you know, then later on, 6 months later, you know, when he came out, I was on Mike and Mike. I was on ABC Good Morning America, and people marveled at my football team. I was so proud. How, with all the social networking, all the things going out, no one said a word, no matter how many people thought it might be true regardless, you know. It never, my guys, but that team was special. They ended up fourth in or fifth in the nation, I believe.
Yeah.
There's something about that team.
Absolutely.
That it could overcome adversity and that it really kind of, I think it's even brought us together closer than what we were. We had great leadership on that team. LaDainian Washington was one of those guys without naming a bunch of other guys, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did also. So I got done talking to him. Then I brought the captains in. I said, talk to me. Sure, I need a team meeting, which this is you know, backtracking here a little bit. But when I had Michael and talked to him, then he leaves, and I have all the captains in there. Talk to me. Tell me what you want me to do with this team. And I think it was LaDainian looked at me and says, Coach, I think I wouldn't do anything right now. Most players thought he probably was.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we got a pretty tight group. We've got good seniors. He said, let it go. I said, well, you got to let daily, I'm going to have you up here, all of you. And you're going to tell me if anything I know or any time during the day. And so we went on for like a week or so where they came up and I had them, anything going on. We had two little minor incidents. And it was pretty amazing. But, you know, when you get older coaching, you kind of sense your kids and you kind of sense your leadership.
And this is one of the best leadership group of kids I had. And I had a bunch of different leadership groups that were really good. But this was really, really, really good. And I just really trusted those guys that they were going to say the right thing at the right time. So I listened to those guys, and it was it allowed us to you know, I think, make a lot of the right moves necessary to protect him and still get through and be successful.
And it translates on the field.
Yeah,
the team
no question.
Was incredibly good, really. Yeah. I'm sure you would say maybe should have been undefeated going into the SEC championship game with that South Carolina back and forth. So you're a one-loss team. Who knew? But it was essentially, again, another national championship semifinal situation with Auburn, except you didn't know until later that night with Ohio State and Michigan State, I think, as you played that night.
Yeah.
And so you're back and forth sitting there with War Eagle. And the SEC, I mean, I remember walking into the George Dome as a guy who went to Missouri going, how in the, first off, I can't believe my alma mater is in a championship game in general, because that's not how it was in the 1990s.
Especially that stadium.
But then in the SEC, and it's like, there are the banners of Alabama, and there's Auburn, and everybody's walked by each other, War Eagle, War Eagle. I'm like, oh my God, my school is playing for the SEC. Oh, it's the best, man. It's the absolute best. Saw Charles Barkley in the lobby of my hotel. He goes, man, you guys should have won that game. You have a great team. Really? And I'm like, wow, this is unbelievable.
Yeah.
So you take me back to that game. Trey Mason just was on fire, but the offense was on fire too. It was a back and forth game. If there's one of the four,
I think it was 50-something, 40-something. 50,
yeah, it was 50, nuts. 56, like 58, 48, 43.
Or something like
yeah,
that.
It's, I mean, it was a 1-point game and a half. How do you view that one when you look back on that one? Do you view that one differently than the Oklahoma one? Because against Oklahoma in 08, they were kind of in a different world at that time, and Alabama was in a different world.
This was a tough football game, and I knew it was going to be, but I thought we played them well. I competed well, but you know, offensively, they just made too many plays. And you know, we made a bunch of plays too, but we just didn't match what you had to do to win that game on that day.
Yeah,
but I was so proud of our players afterwards. You know, really proud of them.
Yeah, I mean, what a year! What a year!
Yeah, what a great year!
And then to be Johnny Manziel here in Columbia and send yourself. I mean, what an absolute atmosphere! And then to duplicate it, but to come back after losing Indiana in September and then return to play
and losing to Georgia.
Yeah. And then get back down to
and get back in it, and play Alabama. And we didn't play that well that game. They were a great football team,
of course.
But I went in the locker room after that game. Remember, and I
against the Alabama game.
And I had to do something to get our confidence back. And so I went in there and just kind of blamed myself. You know, we didn't play near as good as we're capable. We might have got beat anyway, but we are so much better than that. That's what they had to hear from me.
Yeah.
We are so much better than that. I didn't do a very good job at getting you guys ready to play your best. So I own that there. But I want them to, I don't want sitting around saying, well, Alabama's a great team, which they are, and, you know, and we're just, you know, we should have played better. Mm-hmm. We're better than that.
Mm-hmm.
So when we went into our bowl game, the attitude was different in terms of what we had to want to accomplish and what we want to get done.
And set the stage for a win against Minnesota.
Yeah.
Down
in Orlando.
Orlando. So then the off season of this is fascinating to me, and I guess it's personal because I was diagnosed with lymphoma in 2012. An absolutely bizarre situation. You know, what do I know? I went to the University of Missouri Journalism School. I know nothing about medicine, but my doctor called me and said, you know, we looked at the CT scan. You have lymphoma. I wanted to be the one to tell you so you didn't hear it from one of the assistants. This was the chief of staff at the hospital, and he'd been a friend of the family, and I didn't know that you can't diagnose cancer without actual tissue. And so as it turns out, they then go and do a mediastinoscopy, and he tells me, greatest phone call you can ever get, no cancer. Mm-hmm. It was something called sarcoidosis,
which is
very rare for a white male to have. But I got to like read the first chapter of the book, so to speak, in what you are living and what so many other people live. And that was horrifying. So anytime I hear anything regarding anybody getting cancer, I can relate only to that first, you have cancer. So for you, what were you experiencing in the off season health-wise? Because I had this cough that just wouldn't go away.
Yeah, for me, I've always, because of my brother and sister and their health issues their whole life, I've always lived a healthy lifestyle. You know, work out, take care of myself, just because I'm very appreciative every day. I get up and walking around, I feel fine, you know, and that has a lot to do with my background. But I think, you know, when you look at when the situation I was in there, they call it, there's 99 types of lymphoma. And I felt a lymph node right underneath, right on my cheek here. And, Pointed like the people out here that could watch.
Absolutely. If you're watching.
I'm not that naive. I know you can't do that. So unless it's a miracle. And I went in and I've always kind of, anything, I'd go to our trainer, Rex Sharp, anything. And it was almost like, here comes a little kid again.
They think I'm a hypochondriac.
Something else is wrong. Yeah. So I went in there and I went and the doctor looked at it and said, well, I'll just wait a little while. But I didn't want to wait a little while. So he set something up. They did a biopsy and found out I had lymphoma.
Really? So it was just like that.
So, and then
did you have a cough or any other?
No, nothing else.
Just a
nothing
else. Just a swollen lymph node.
I felt fine.
This was May?
It was right around my birthday. I think the day I found out I had it was on my birthday.
Oh, jeez.
In 15. And so it startles you. I mean, I just got back from Mayo actually 3 days ago.
You were just in the Mayo?
I just got back and it's still in remission. And eventually, like my doctor said, you're going to get treatment again someday because it's going to come back. It's never going to leave you. And that's the way it is. And I always say there's a lot of people with a lot more difficult cancers, and God bless all them, because that's important for me to say that. But it was really tough because I really live a healthy lifestyle, and I just couldn't. I say this because I want people that people that have cancer, we're on the same team, and they understand what I mean. You're looking at a mirror, you're driving a car, and you're looking at your rear view mirror, and you're going, I got blank blank cancer.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? Yeah. And it was just mind boggling. It really was. And so, anyway, I had 3 weeks of treatment up at Mayo, and got married 15 days later. Oh, by the way,
yeah.
Oh, by the way,
yeah. Here's my May of 2015.
And told very few people. One thing for me is I did not want this to be. I did not tell anybody, and did not tell my team because I did not want it to interfere with our player team's focus in any way. I didn't want that at all. Mm-hmm. I could have told people real easily and went with it. But as time was going on here, I was just wondering, you get married in July, June, and then you got July and August, you get going, all the stuff you get going with football. And you're just kind of wondering if you're doing the right thing with your time. Because I didn't know if I'm going to go 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, or 5 years. And I started getting treatment.
As in and coach
yeah,
two?
Yeah, three, coach okay. more. And then, I'm gone, 80 hours a week, a lot of times, all those things. And I just, I just kind of reevaluated myself and, what my priorities. I got 8 grandkids and I love coaching, but at the end of the day, I don't want to sit there 3 years from now and regret that I just stayed in that, high level work pace, which is even greater than when you back away from it than you ever thought, mm-hmm. and didn't spend my time right with my family and friends and things like that. And then eventually got to that point. Also I saw when I was at Mayo, I saw a lot of people at Mayo, older people that were there, and not just cancer, but all different types. And it's a remarkable place, hospital. And I just, all that, they're, at one time they were diagnosed and I just, it just, for me, some guys might have stayed and said, I'm going to stick with it and go with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just decided, all the way actually through the season, I just kept going back and forth with it a little bit, do I really want to do this? Which is not very good, to be honest with you, during the season. But I did it, obviously, at times when it wasn't affecting anything no one knew anything that was going on with me. And then right before our bye week, I think, or the week of our bye week, I think I went up at that time and they said I was clean. So it's in remission because of the treatments that I had 4 months prior to. And at that time I decided again, I was just not, I came back right from that day. And I asked, Mac Rhodes, I said, can I meet with you tomorrow morning? I met with him and I walked in and I told him that I'm going to retire after this season. I got to prioritize my life in the right way. And
what was his reaction?
Yeah,
he knew.
Well,
right?
he did know.
Okay,
he did know, and also after this point when I told him, it was also coming down the road here in terms of him having to tell the curators because they're gonna have to look for someone else. The reason I told him at the time and I didn't announce it to my team, I did not want to be a distraction because if it's a distraction, you're not gonna win your games. It's just you can't focus,
mm-hmm.
and so I didn't want to tell anybody. And I didn't plan on telling anybody till maybe the last game possibly.
Right.
And do it that way. And then it got leaked.
Right.
It got leaked out.
Do you have any idea how that happened?
Some of the university systems did that knew. Whether it was a curator or somebody else.
Doesn't that just disgust you?
First of all, it's against law.
Yes.
Number one.
Yeah.
Number two, it's just absolutely incredible. And it was so tough for my players. I'm telling them on a Friday, boarding the buses, all of a sudden I have to have a team meeting. I got lymphoma and I'm going to retire. And the coaches look white because pale. I mean, they were just, it looks like they got hit with it, got in a wreck. You know, they had security with me like hardly very few programs in the country have. And it was just a very difficult time, you know. And
Did you think you beat it to the punch before it got public that you got to your players before they started seeing it pop up?
Yeah, I think I got that. Yeah. I did get that. But I had to do it. I had to get it out because if I didn't do it, I was not going to have them hear it for somebody else.
Yeah.
And the players looked stunned. But it's still, in that game, it was like win one for the Gipper.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because my players, you know, they really didn't understand. It happened on Friday and Saturday. They really didn't. After that week, we had a couple games left. The whole thing was gone.
Right.
Our coaches were, you could tell, were different. My players were different. It was just kind of, they were walking around, just kind of going through no matter what I did. You know, it's very fortunate because I thought we could have finished that season and go to a bowl game.
Yeah.
But anyway, it came out the way it did, and you know, certainly was disappointing.
Well, I didn't realize you were in remission. That was right on the Mississippi State game. It was a Thursday night game, and then I think there was a week off. Perhaps
and that's
right
when the thing happened at campus too.
Yes, well,
right after that,
exactly. So
I think it was about 10 days after I told 10 or 11 days after. I guess there's this conspiracy theory that they
there is, but it's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah,
you could get every curator who knew about it at that time. So it's not even it's very easy to prove.
I mean, it's. You know, when something is as serious as cancer, and then it's a podcast, so I can use whatever language I want with all due respect, of course, but it's a really shitty thing for somebody to leak something, A, regarding something that serious, but then on top of that, then you have multiple people going, well, see, he did this, so now they're coming up with something to make it look like, I mean, and you're sitting there dealing, and your family is dealing with...
Yeah, but that didn't bother me because it wasn't true. So truth is truth.
And right.
And at the end of the day, that comes out. I mean, it was not even, you know, I can... You know, Mac Rose could put a stack of Bibles in front of me.
Right.
What I did, and all curators knew about it. I mean, there's a bunch of people that knew. There's several people that knew, not a bunch, several people that knew. Chad Moeller knew. He had to know what was going on.
Yeah.
Okay? And so my secretary had to know, who I trusted very well. Mm-hmm. So there's a few other people that I told, but anyway.
November 2015 is one for the ages.
Yeah.
I mean, you've had a lot of, you talk about Novembers.
Yeah.
And you write in your book, it's about your players coming in saving someone's life. That's the term use. I always looked at that thing, 'cause I know people were going, God, what does he do here? You know, I mean, it's the proverbial, from my standpoint, again, 1,000 miles away, no win situation. Mm-hmm. So when you look back on that in the 100-yard journey, you say, I don't know really what I could have done differently. Is that a fair way to...
Well, first of all, I explained there's a procedure when something happens. When something like this happens and you know, kind of not a crisis, but something serious is happening, I call my... And I talk about it in there. It's a procedure you follow. I've done it every year since I've been here. So you just don't start thinking about trying, let's solve it this way, solve it that way. We don't function. Our program's not like that. And the 25 years of head coach, you talk to the AD, talks to the other people, administrators, and then you come to a decision what you're going to do and how you're going to handle it. And it's always been that way. And so I talk about that a little bit and how the thing came out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, and I also say in the book this was not about agenda. They didn't come in and say, coach, if they don't change these five things, we're not going to play. There were not five things involved with this, okay? All they wanted to do was have this kid live. That's all they cared about. And so that's the way it went down. That's the way it was. And people say to me, "Boy, I feel so bad that happened to you." Well, that's kind of what the book's about. You know, life, you don't choose everything that's going to happen to you. I had a lot of things happen to me, you know. And a lot of people had a lot worse things that happened to them in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of the battle you have, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you play the best hand you can. And I thought we did the right thing at the right time. And our administration, Mac said that, you know, we got to support our kids on this. I agreed. And I say in the book, too, I say, you know, if Mac would have said, no, we can't do that, we'd have had a deep discussion and maybe we wouldn't have. But I would like to think I still would have done the same thing. But and as I say in the book, it never got that far.
Yeah. Do you think the way you were raised, citing that incident with the N-word in 1960, 62, whenever it was, being certainly cognizant of the relations between St. Louis and the University of Missouri, do you think that played a role in the way that you handled it versus potentially... somebody else?
I don't know. I just understood that. I mean, I just think it was the right thing to do. That's what I felt. And The other side of that, what if we wouldn't have? And if you heard all the pundits and all the people on TV sports talked about, you know, as I would hear that, and you go back and tape them up, they said they'll never, if they wouldn't have done that, they would never got a black player forever to go there. No one ever thinks about that side. And the other side.
Well, it was talked about at the time.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, we did the right thing. But I didn't make the final decision. I don't make those final decisions. Right. I could disagree, and the decision is going to go with my boss. It is. It never got that far to have mm-hmm. to do that. But it's, you know, things happen
yeah.
and it happens. And, you know, I don't think, you know, obviously there were some administrative leadership problems on our campus. It was obviously, you know, I had nothing to do with any of that, anything. I just kind of got to throw in my lap on right. a Saturday night.
All
but,
right.
You know, and sometimes you do what's right and you pay the consequences. The other thing is, in tough times like this, really difficult times, the best in people come out and the absolute worst in people come out. And we saw a lot of the worst, people climbing out of the rocks, you know, attacking the university. And that's very disappointing.
I still feel like, even now, people watch what happened against Auburn. People watch what happened against Purdue. Well, it all started in November 2015.
It's easy to throw that at them. Mm-hmm. By the way, no one was ever hurt there.
Mm-hmm.
No one ever got hurt. You know, I was on May 4th when four students got shot and killed.
Right.
Okay. So, I mean, and did the university handle that whole situation the best way? I don't necessarily agree they did. You know, I wouldn't handle that, you know, that particular way. That's like having a bad recruiting year and then tell everybody we're not going to be good for the next 2 years. Right. They came out a month afterwards and talked about how the enrollment's going to drop, this is going to drop.
What was the point of that?
What would I do if after a recruiting class I'd sit there and say, well, after this class isn't very good, we're not going to be very good the next year. That's a complete wrong attitude to attack this. And I'm not, you know, it was very difficult for people coming in leading. I understand that, you know, and they got thrown into all this stuff too. So I'm not throwing any arrows at any of these people. I just felt we could have handled it a lot better and be so more, much more proactive.
Yeah.
Like right that year afterwards, for example, that we had the second best retention rate in the history. All the kids on the campus came back. The second best retention rate in the history of the university of the kids on that campus. You didn't even know that. And there was a couple other statistics that were absolutely awesome. And no one did anything. I just said thanks to our students. And we raised more money that year than ever in the history of university. I'd have went St. Louis newspaper, and I did. I called people to ask them to do it. Kansas City paper, Springfield paper, Columbia paper, and take a big ad out and thank our fans and thank our as we go through our challenges, and we're going to get better and we're going to improve. You know, these are the things that we could do.
Because
I just felt it could have been handled a lot better.
Right, because it sets a tone as if we did something wrong and we're ashamed of it, hope you still support us, opposed to here is what actually...
Well, it's the Ziggy syndrome a little bit. You sit back and woe is me. You know, how tough this is going to be,
Yeah.
You know, and you know, I just think it could have been handled better.
Yeah.
And that's probably not the nice thing to say and the right thing to say, but it's honest.
But it's honest.
It's honest. Like, everything I did said in that book was honest.
So along those lines, I don't think people necessarily maybe, maybe they do say this to you, would say, I'm sorry this happened to you, Coach, or I'm sorry this happened to you, Gary. But considering that this incredible run, the best run in Missouri football history for a coach, ends with not only you're sitting there, you know, getting cancer treatment, brutal in and of itself, mm-hmm. and then you also... if I have that happen as the proper uh-huh. term, that just, you know, I mean,
but that's life, you know, that, you know, you handle it, it's thrown at you, you deal with it, you know, mm-hmm. You know, I had several things that I had to deal with, you know, personnel issues that I had to deal with here that were a lot of places that may not have to do those. And
sure.
we always did what the right thing was. And you don't choose, you don't want everything to choose rosy and nice out and everything else. And it didn't at the end of the day, but that's what that book's about, the battle. You know, that it's not. And by the way, a lot of people have a lot worse battles than Gary Pinkel does. Yeah, and I, you know, I'd really admire how people attack all those also.
I'm curious what you think as you watch a guy who you worked with and you know, and I would imagine like quite a bit, and Barry Odom deal with what he's dealing with here in his second season.
Yeah, it's very difficult. It's a tough job. I talk in the book about when Coach Jim and I became the head coach at Toledo and I was leaving Seattle. And I went into Coach James' office, and I went into him, and he hugged him and thanked him. I started walking out, and I looked back, and I said, because I thought, you know, I said, Coach, you have any words of wisdom there? And he goes, yeah, I have some. He looked at it with his eyes, you know, those blue-green eyes. He looked at me and he said, yeah. He says, he looked at me and said, Gary, when things get tough, and they're going to get really, really tough, you got to wake up every morning and you got to focus hour by hour with all your attention on doing your job. And you don't let all this. Well, now with cell phones and all this stuff, right, there's much more of this coming in, attacking, you know, that you have to keep out. And I walked away, you know, me being a young guy, first year head coach, I think I'm 36 years old, you know, I'm excited. You know, I walked away and said, that's not bad advice. And I just walked out. and then, oh my gosh, it was like the greatest thing I ever was told, yeah, you know, because I've seen it eat coaches up. It's so hard. You're thinking about all the stuff,
right,
rather than doing your job. And it's just difficult. And I just hope and pray that, you know, Barry, you know, can do that. And I have confidence that he can.
I imagine you've talked.
Yeah, I've talked to him this week right now, but I've talked to him, you know, two, three, four times during the season so far. And it's a tough job. It's difficult. And, yeah, you know, but you got to fix things too. You know, that's the most important things. If you're not tackling well, you got to start tackling better. If you're turning the ball over and not getting enough turnovers, you got to get turnover margin on our side. You know, our offense, which was very potent a year ago, we got to start playing better, because this offense I've seen move all over the place. Mm-hmm. Let's crank it up and get going, start winning games, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm sure he's doing all those things, you know. You got to fix problems. And I think, you know, the bye week's really good right now for Barry, because I think he can, you know, take a deep breath, maybe talk to some team players that he needs to talk to. And it's a good time to kind of get a fresh start.
Yeah.
And all you need is a victory here. And then you get a couple, and then things can start rolling the other way. And that's certainly what I hope.
Did you like seeing the fire? That wasn't necessarily him publicly in the past couple of years.
Well, I think what
Auburn
happens is you get in very, it's very difficult situations you get into. And it's the same thing I talked about. You know, it's the same thing. You gotta be able to separate all those things. And I don't know that I ever did anything quite like that, but I might have. You know, I don't. As I look back, I did it for many years. Maybe at Toledo, I did it. You guys didn't get a chance to see it. But you know, one thing that I learned that I did when I was really, really, really upset, I would go into a room, the bathroom or something, in the locker room, or go somewhere where I could shut a door, and I'd stay there about a minute and a half or 2 minutes.
Cool down period.
And just chill. And I wasn't a very good chiller. Okay? But I had to, you know, get back to, you know, what Coach James said to me, you know.
Yeah.
When things get tough, you know, you take the blame, and when they're going well, you throw it out. And so I think, you know, he'll learn that lesson.
Yeah.
You know, you don't like seeing – I've seen so many coaches – not make it because of not their ability to handle the pressure. And then Barry's a very tough, mentally tough guy. So I certainly hope he's going
to
do it.
I don't know how you talked about being able to block. I mean, I just don't know how. I mean, I've done it, I guess. I know there are places I go, I would read horrible things about myself, and I just don't go there.
Yeah.
Did you do, when you were coaching, people say, I don't read the press, and then you're like, oh, sure you
no,
do.
I never did. I never read the press, anything about myself after my second year at Toledo. And that was so the next 23 years, I never read anything about me, ever. And the neat thing about it is majority of the stuff were good overall, I mean, by far. But I never did it to make my ego feel good, and I never did it for suggestions. I would call up Coach James or Coach Lauderer, who used to be head coach at Toledo. I'd call people up that I know that would give me honest answers to help me with things like that. And, you know, that's just... It's just the way you deal with it.
Let me quick hit you on the way out here. Mm-hmm. Favorite moment at Froh Field? I'm going to make a play on Oklahoma 2010, but then I think there's a chance it might be Texas A&M 2013.
Yeah, that Texas A&M 2013 would be the biggest game ever played at that time in our stadium, because it was to win the SEC's championship. It was a championship game. If you win the game, you go to the championship game. If you lose it, you don't. You're still going to go to a bowl game. So I think that was the biggest game in the history of that stadium.
Wow.
And there was a lot of great games.
Absolutely.
And we were at 2003 Nebraska. I mean, I can go through a bunch of big, big wins we had in that mm-hmm. place. But that game, you know, just what it meant,
mm-hmm.
it was really, really huge. And, you know, people ask me about all the games you played. I had a game at Penn State. You know, we beat Penn State my last year.
2000 at Toledo.
And we beat them. And I remember on the little card that I write on during the game, put notes on, I put 5 minutes left. I put slashes, one, tooth, you know, like you know, and then I, a minute would go, I'd, nobody knew that, but I'm sitting there as we're beating Nebraska, we're beating Purdue, and I'm in Toledo, we're beating Purdue by, I mean,
Penn State,
we're beating them by, I don't know, like 13 points or 14 points, and I'm just, I'm kind of, Joe Paterno's on the other side, who's one of my idols, I read his books and everything, and so, you know, slash it down, we win the game, and after the game, I think I said this in the book, after the game, I was generally games like that, players pick you up and carry you off the field. One player came over and hugged me, and then I looked on the field and all my players are in line shaking hands with Joe Paterno. I had a line across the field. So you know what I did? I just got in line. And I had, it was really cool because ESPN came up and interviewed me in line and said, what's going on here? I said, you know, we're excited about shaking hands with Coach Paterno. And, you know, that was a big, big win, huge win. And that kind of got me back on the map a
Absolutely.
Little bit as far as a guy out there, you know, looking for jobs. You know, the game in Kansas City,
it has to be.
2007 is one of the great you know in season environments, and I've coached in Rose Bowls and Orange Bowls. I've coached in a lot of neat bowl games, you know, Cotton Bowls, and you know here and all this other stuff. And there's so many great ones, but those are there to mention.
Absolutely,
a few.
Because in each one you're talking about, they're essentially like a quarterfinal or a semifinal of the national championship in each one.
Yes.
13
yeah.
and then the
yeah.
seven.
We win two of those games and we're in the national championship.
Absolutely.
So my point is that people don't say Missouri can't get there. You know, we were knocking.
Absolutely.
Don't say how many people were even knocking.
Yeah.
Like 85% of the universities never knock.
I would ask Tony La Russa these kinds of questions. Oh, I don't want to disrespect anybody. So if I'm out of line, I'm out of line. What was the best team you had at Missouri?
I can't answer that. People have said
it'd be 07 or 13.
Is it 07 or 13?
Yeah.
That's what everybody says.
Right.
I say 08 might have been. Maybe because I coached better. Maybe it might have been 08, but it probably would have been one of those two. You know, but I really watch myself out there because you know there's kids out there who have such great pride. You know, like those players that were freshmen, sophomore when we got here, the ones that stuck with us. You know, we got to a bowl in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And that was huge for our football program. And then we got back to it in 5. And they were all those guys when it wasn't a very fun time to be around here. So every group of guys that came in their seasons had their mark
right
on the resurgent of Missouri football. And I'm certainly very proud of
it. And you want to pay your, understandably, you want to pay your respects to if there is a guy you coached who you look at and go, this guy could wind up doing what I wound up doing in my coaching career. Who would that be? I'm going to make a guess again. I like to answer. I'll Chase Daniels.
Yeah,
seems,
probably.
Is that the guy?
But I don't think Chase. I think Chase sees the lifestyle. And that's what's happening now. You know, kids will come up to me. A lot of players the last few years come up to me and say, you know, about getting into coaching. And I just explain to them, you got to understand. You know, and they see the lifestyle. When you're there 4 or 5 years, do you really want to work like that?
Yeah.
And
they don't just hand you a head coaching gig.
Yeah, I think Chase, you know, was more interested in maybe being a high school coach when he's done.
Yeah.
And he has a couple businesses going on. Obviously, he's making a lot of good money, and he's smart about what he does. But he would be a great coach. And then there's probably about another dozen guys that certainly would, too.
Yeah, which is a tribute. Yeah. As far as your favorite coach that you interacted throughout the state of Missouri while they were with a coach or manager, because I always felt like you had a rapport with La Russa. I didn't know if you had anybody on the Kansas City side that you would get together and –
Yeah, I report with Tony La Russa. You know, I was invited to that
ARF.
I think that's what it is. And I ran into him once. We were in Clayton. He just happened to go into dinner. I was by myself. We sat down together, and this is the other one that remember we had the slow start.
Yeah,
and
the
Cardinals, and he was telling me what a good team they had. You know, and he said I got a couple guys. I got a. You know, there's some things that I have to do, you know, whether he didn't say who it was, but either remove a player or trade and get rid of a guy or whatever. And I think, you know, this could be a really, really good team. And I'm thinking, you know, they're just, you know, barely, you know, hanging 500 here, you know,
uh-huh.
but had a great talk with him, I mean, really. And so now there's other things that I've been, you know, different foundations that I've been to a dinner with him and really had a good relationship with him and had tremendous respect for him. And I loved his press conference because people always made fun of me. They say, look, watch his press conference. Cause he's, you know, I'm grumpy and everything else like that.
Man.
He's the grumpiest of all grumps, man. And you know what? I loved him. If I was there, I'd be up high fiving him. So, God, he was brutal.
I was on the receiving end.
I know
end
he
that.
Was brutal.
Oh my God. He lit my ass up, man. I'm like, oh my God, I gotta ask. And I know it's going to be brutal.
Media people weren't his favorite people at the time.
Right.
Were not his favorite people.
Yeah, and I understand.
And those guys, I mean, you talk about press conferences, you got 166 of them, right?
Yeah, yeah. 162 games. Yeah, and he would always go to the playoffs, yeah, so probably so, like 175.
I mean, it goes on.
Right.
So, yeah.
You had 12, 13, 14, and how do you think, when you, do you ever watch, the, you don't watch your games, I doubt you ever watch your press conferences.
No, I've never watched press conferences at all. Yeah. So
that's brutal. I mean, it's a brutal thing because you got to protect your players.
Well, one thing,
you're happy, really happy, or really pissed off.
Yeah. Well, you got to just be kind of consistent.
Yeah.
But, you know, I one thing I thought was so important to me is that you don't read the newspapers. You know what's going on. I knew what was going on. Chad Mueller would meet me every Sunday night or Monday morning, and he would tell me exactly what my players are hearing. We'd also watch about how our players communicated in the media, because that was, we had rules on how we did things, standards that we had to have. But I knew everything that was going on in terms of just what the clutter is.
Right.
Because I had to, because I deal with my players. So I didn't just live in this box and say, well, heck with everything else. I couldn't do that. You know, me running that organization, I had to be at least aware of what's going on without, you know, listening to it.
So it seems like at a great spot here. House is phenomenal. I don't want to give away locations, but it's a nice area. Not a surprise there. You could be hanging out doing whatever you want to do. How do you spend your time now? What do you want to be doing?
Well, I spend a lot of time in this book. I got four or five speaking engagements coming up the next, you know, next 4 months, 3 months. Most important, I get to do anything I want to do. I probably would like to write another book.
What would that be? I mean, everything.
More of a business book, more of a leadership book, more of a book of, you know, kind of, maybe about the formula to win.
Yeah, I'd like to know what the hell this program is,
and you know the details of what we did and how it was, and so I'd like to do that if that presents itself.
Yeah,
but like I said, the most important thing I could do, I can do anything I want to do.
Yeah, that's the best.
That's the best. And I'm trying to get back at golf because since I became the head coach here, I became awful.
What's the handicap?
And I don't even want to tell you.
Okay.
And I am been so inconsistent. I just get so mad. It's like, let's go out and play golf and feel like heck. Yeah, okay, let's go play. Oh, how do you feel? I feel like hell. How do you feel? I feel great. I'm glad we played. But my wife the other day told me, she said, your attitude's not very good. And she's probably right. She goes, you can't get better at golf with a bad attitude. And so, you know, that's the attitude stuff I've talked about my whole life. So she kind of hit me in the mouth with it. So I'd like to, because it's kind of get your competitive spirit.
Absolutely.
You know, to be able to do that.
So it sucks when you go out there and you're not very good. I understand.
Yeah,
it's frustrating.
Yeah, but for me, I can't emotionally handle it like you can. So,
like,
but I can't. I put my mind to it. I can do it.
Yeah.
I can do anything. And I will do that to be able to get that done. So now I also got 8 grandkids and I got a family, you know, and our family went to Sandestin, all 18 of us.
Oh,
went
how cool is that?
Sandestin for 5 days, five nights, 6 days. Had a great time. We're going to do it every 2 years, our whole family. It was like the greatest time ever. We spent time with each other the entire time. It was awesome. So, yeah, you know, there's a lot of other opportunities out there possibly, but you know, I also don't want to work full time. I've been helping the university. I got something going on in Chicago here pretty soon, and I'll be out of contract with them pretty soon. So, but I'm okay.
Yeah. Do you intend on staying in Columbia? Or?
Oh yeah, I've always been in Columbia, you know, at the lake, both places.
Right.
My wife owns a magazine called LO Profile.
Okay.
And she's a publisher of it, and
very
I'll be
cool.
Before I leave, she just had her 10th anniversary.
Wow,
it's really good. 350 people. She helped Dave and I, you know, with the book and editing part of it. Uh-huh. That's what she does for a living, and with her magazines. And by the way, Dave did an awesome job.
That's right.
You know, first of all, he had to put up with me, for, you know, sitting like we're sitting right now,
uh-huh.
You know, 2.5 hours, you know, for 12 weeks. And then reviewing things, going them over to make sure we get things the right way.
Dave Matter, our cohort at 590.
He does
absolutely.
An excellent job.
Another St. Louis U High guy. God bless him. Well, it truly is. It is. The name of the book is The 100-Yard Journey, A Life in Coaching and Battling for the Win. And it's a great read. It engrosses you. And I know a lot of Missouri fans are like, I just want to read the Missouri stuff. Read the whole thing because it kind of gives you an idea of what the foundation was to get you to the success that Missouri fans got to experience.
My daughter-in-law, by the way, my son Blake, he lives in Kansas City, just told me today, says, well, Jenny says, Dad, Jenny just skipped all the football stuff. She knows all that stuff. She wanted to know the first half, how I grew up. She didn't really know any of that. So I said, well, let's get this thing together here. So I said, first of all, you better read all of it. So that's the first thing.
It's a great one. Coach Pinkel, thanks for letting us into the home, and it was a pleasure to talk with you.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
So there it is, 82 minutes with former Missouri head coach Gary Pinkel. Very grateful for his time at his home in Columbia. The book is The 100-Yard Journey, A Life in Coaching and Battling for the Win. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to the Morning After podcast, as we will have the first few episodes in the TMA podcast feed. Then we're going to at least plan to have our own dedicated podcast feed. The Cat is going to be doing a podcast starting in November. So hopefully this is the beginning of multiple podcasts and multiple interviews. Over the next couple of weeks, we'll have more long-form interviews with former U.S. Senator Jack Danforth discussing in depth his op-ed piece in the Washington Post recently, calling President Trump the most divisive politician in the United States since George Wallace. Danforth, the Republican senator, explains why he does not view President Trump as a Republican. And we get into how he nearly was both George H.W. Bush's and George W. Bush's running mate in 1988 and 2000, and whether or not he regrets not being a part of those two presidential runs. We also sit down with Clay Travis, as he's going to be in St. Louis, and talk about his career and his view on a variety of issues that have certainly gotten him national attention. I love getting your feedback. I've just always done this whenever I, whether it be television, radio, writing, whatever the case might be, for real, I want it. I don't care if it's positive or negative. It's helpful. So you can email me at tmckernan@insidestl.com. Regarding the Pinkel interview, as I look back on that, regrets, I got to criticize myself. I feel like I left one out on the golf course by not asking about the uniforms. I really would have liked to have gotten his thoughts on that, because he actually does address it in the 100-Yard Journey about the choice to go from the Block M to the Tiger logo. And that's one thing. But the Bumblebee uniforms and all that, I feel like I left one out on the golf course there, so I'm upset with myself there. I also thought, really, I thought he would have gotten more in depth on the two championship game losses where at least seemed like Missouri had a shot. And I'm talking about 2007 against Oklahoma and San Antonio, where they were a win away from playing for the national championship, and 2013 against Auburn, where they were a win away, as it turned out, from playing for the national championship. Because later that night, if I'm not mistaken, Michigan State lost to Ohio State, and that would have opened the door for Missouri to play Florida State. If memory serves, it was one or the other. But either way, that essentially was a national championship semifinal, and in both cases, Missouri just didn't have it. And I would have thought that that would stick with Pinkel a little bit more than it seems to. But maybe that's part of the maturity and the retirement, and also having a focus on your health that you're able to compartmentalize a little bit more effectively. But as far as the interview, as far as the thoughts he had on November 2015, as far as him going in depth on his health, and as far as really almost year by year of his tenure in Columbia, I just sat there and enjoyed listening, because that was a lot of information and opinion that I had never heard before. So hopefully you felt the same way. And ideally, as we go forward, that will be the theme of our long form interviews. But like I said, if you have any feedback, any suggestions for who you'd like to hear, if you want to advertise on our podcast, all of those things, we welcome you to email me anytime at tmckernan@insidestl.com. That's how you can contact me anytime. tmckernan@insidestl.com. Thank you for tuning in for the very first edition of the Tim McKernan Show. For my producer, John Seymour, I'm Tim McKernan. Thank you for listening to the first edition of the Tim McKernan Show.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.